Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Mian, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
I mean, let me ask you this. Has in the art realm of podcasts, have two podcasts ever, like Wonder Twin Powers, activate each other to like make one giant episode of a podcast of like
the Traveling Wilburys of
Wait, I thought that's what we're doing right now. We are
that's exactly what's happening.
It's like an Avengers movie.
It's totally
the best superheroes are in one place.
It's like the beginning of Captain America Civil War, when all of a sudden you're like, oh my god, it's Captain America, Iron Man, and Spider-Man all, and Thor all in one.
And Thor.
I'm Spider-Man.
I was thinking,
no, I wanted to be Spider-Man.
No, you're Thor. Look at you. You have like the ponytail, everything.
And I'm bald.
I was actually thinking it'd be more like in Lord of the Rings, so the council of, you know, like remember the magic council was like
one podcast to rule them all. Welcome to Suggested Grind Podcast. My name is Edward Minhoff.
I'm Tony Serenai.
I'm Marshall Jones.
All right. Hi, I'm Dina Brodsky, and I'm here to tell you about a special offer that I have. I'm offering therapy for a 10% discount. I can also birth your babies if you're into that. I do bathtubs, swimming pools, at-home hospitals, doula services.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ted Minhoff of Suggested Donation Podcast about to introduce this episode of Fun Do It.
Two art podcasts coming together to talk about the art world and other such things. Friends, we've had Ted on, we've had Tony on separately. Dina and I do the Art Grind Podcast, and Tony Sear and I, Ted Minhoff, do Suggested Donation Podcast.
We're
coming together for your listening pleasure.
I mean, what a great way to kind of start.
Well done. Bravo.
Thank you.
Coming out of the summer into the, you know, coming into the fall, not yet, but coming into the fall. What a great way to kind of hit, you know, kind of
back to school podcast.
Launch a new season or of podcasts that will be coming down the pike for a while. I mean, this is a great way to do it. That's curious to know kind of the behind the scenes of what it takes to you know, do a podcast as working artists in this world. I think you're the one who brought it up, the idea of it. And I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. We should totally do that. And here we are.
So by the way, I brought this up about 6 months ago. This podcast took longer to arrange than like peace treaties between warring nations. seriously, I feel like civil wars have been fought. You know, the like treaties, like documents have been signed, and meanwhile, we're still trying to get ourselves together on Zoom. But we did it. Like we're all here. I think that was as focused as we're going to be. We don't have to be focused anymore. We can just relax
and resume.
We're gonna start spiraling now. That was the event horizon we're going in now. But, you know, I see back to Ted, what you're saying about even emails, like sometimes we'll get emails and, you know, with suggestions that I think are great, guest suggestions and all that, but every once in a while, and it hasn't lately, but people would be like, oh, you should do this and you should do that. And I'm like, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to do this, to arrange for people to be there, to sort of have a good conversation, to mix it, to edit it, to put it out for free. You know, yeah. And we're not taking any sponsors because I know that Ted and I were like, we just want outside of like Trekkle, you know, Trekkle supports
Trekkle,
us.
Great art supplies at low prices.
Great prices. Go to Trekkle.com. Get yourself some. Yeah. But it's tough to do these and put them out. But I feel like it's one, it's a worthy endeavor to do, because I think it's really interesting to have these conversations and put them out for people.
Why do you guys think it's important? Or do you think it's important?
Oh, I do. I think it's very important. I think it's been a huge blessing in my life having these conversations with people. I think it's improved my art practice. I think it's definitely changed my values on what I think is important in art. I do think there is something a little challenging about the audience and just the structure of it. Like you were saying, Tony, like if anyone's like, you know, maybe unwanted suggestions or whatever, or just knowing that there's people listening, it is a little bit like, okay, but it is a bit of a service that way, you know? Like, I think the things, I always just keep in mind the things that I've gotten out of it, I have to assume the listeners are getting the same thing out of it, you know?
Marshall, was there ever
things? Go ahead.
Sorry, was there ever a moment, what you just said, that changed your opinion or something? Is there anything that sticks out in memory that you were like, huh? That's something that's,
oh my God, this would be good. Like then you could play a clip from that show. Note to editor. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, Marshall.
Editor right now is so pissed. But yeah,
but it's like one of those best of shows.
One of those 90s sitcoms.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like flashbacks.
You have to do
the whole episode with clips.
And guys, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's such a good idea. We should do that.
So many, like, I gotta say, like, I feel like it's really honed my focus on what I think is important in art. Like, there recently, like, we interviewed Betty Cunningham she's got an amazing gallery. And I was just like, what makes your taste so good? Because so many people, and this is all just me saying, but so many galleries do not have good taste. Betty Cunningham has consistently had great taste for a long time. It varies a little bit. Sure, it has somewhat of a consistent aesthetic. And I didn't know what it was because it's not, you know, you can't just say, well, she likes the color blue or something, you know? So, and I was like, what is that you look for? How do you consistently have such good taste? She didn't like the word taste, but that's another story. And she was like, I look for people who figure things out on the canvas. And I was like, oh my God, that's 100% right. And it's like, there's something powerful about art when you're shelving what you know, and you're just going and creating something and discovering new, you know, every day it's a little bit of a battle. And it was so interesting to me that someone could actually key into that and put it into words, that's the aesthetic. And that has definitely changed the way I look at art, you know, because it's like, that's what I would like to be, someone who's constantly figuring something out new every day, rather than just sort of wrote, I know how to do this. This is how I do it over and over again, you know?
Well, that also sounds boring.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then another guest called that, Sam Adoki called that unseen beauty. I'm blanking on his name. He was the New York Times art critic, but he said he always looks for surprise in what he does. It's like, just like all these sort of recurring themes about people who look at art a lot have different words to say that this stuff's supposed to be surprising to the artist and the viewer, you know, it's not just supposed to be some autopilot thing.
So. I've often left, you know, when Ted and I would pack up our equipment or something like that, especially when we were doing, you know, more live stuff in the beginning. And I would, you know, the guests would leave and Ted and I would sort of sit there and be like, oh, you know, there's a few that I was just like, that just, whoa, that totally was like, not what I expected, or that was really inspiring. Even if it's not something that I'm, you know, do or anything, there's that, passion that would come out. And I think one of the powers of the podcast, the ability to do a long form conversation, is that first 15, even 20 minutes is that kind of uncomfortable getting warmed up. And then all of a sudden, hopefully once they're eased in and the guest doesn't feel like we're trying to trick them or anything like that, they start expressing themselves. And then you can see there's a couple of times when I've saw that there was legit like passion and they were really excited to talk about what they're excited about. And I think sometimes that stuff gave me like inspired me, meaning it wasn't necessarily a specific thing. They said, I do this thing. It was that love. You can hear it. And I think you can hear that outside of our bad dad jokes that Ted and I
your
do.
Your bad dad. Like,
my playbook of dad jokes is that passion comes out, that love, that beauty of what they're doing. And I'd leave the conversation being like, I need to take that with me.
But that's the whole purpose of the podcast is like all the like hanging out with artists and talking to them and walking away feeling inspired and walking away feeling maybe like a little bit drunk. And also like, you just want to get to the studio, like fast forward to that moment when you're in the studio, because you just feel so full of like ideas and inspiration that you just want to like get back to work. And I mean, there are a number of people, but like, there's so many artists where like I can, anytime I sit down with them, I have that feeling. And that's, for me, that's like the purpose of the podcast. And if anybody listening to it gets that, then I feel like we've done something great.
Mm. You know, I feel like it gets you out of your own head, which is where most of us, especially like if we have spent all day in the studio, that's where most of us are. Like we're just inside our own head, which is, you know, sometimes an interesting place to be, but sometimes also like frustrating or, you know, or anxious or whatever. And it gets us into someone else's head, because I think the whole point of it is listening, right? So Marshall taught me this word during this podcast, which I recently found out isn't an actual word, right? Marshall, the word Sonder, which I thought was the best word ever. And I've been using it in conversation and telling everyone about it. And which is defined as sort of the realization that other people's lives are as important and interesting and complex as your own. This is apparently not a real world word. It comes from the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, which is kind of this dictionary of words.
Hey, don't write off the Dictionary of Obscured Sorrows. That's where I get my whole vocabulary.
Sounds like a Harry Potter dictionary.
Don't delegitimize that.
It's actually wonderful that for anyone who hasn't read the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, it's a book of words that, you know, that don't exist, but everyone feels like it should. Like the word for the feeling that your life is ordinary, right? The fear of your life being completely ordinary, or like the fake guilt you feel when doing something completely not out of bounds, like driving under the speed limit by a police officer and feeling somehow guilty, like all the stuff that we've experienced, but there's no actual word for.
But usually it's an expression like FOMO, fear of missing out, or something like that, which is like a thing that so many people do now because we've been inundated by the computer and our phones to feel like, oh, look what's going on in the world and you're not a part of it. You know, it's like the fear of missing out. But that one word, Marshall, I mean, one, it reminds me of, it's another version of empathy, you know, this idea of that it's an empathy, you know, it's just another. But Dina, if the word exists, now you're saying, then, I mean, if the word, if you're telling us the word and the meaning, I feel like the word exists. Like, I don't, there is no such thing. It's a real word now. So who's to say that it doesn't exist?
I think that word kind of became, you know, like that's the one thing out of that book that started getting used outside of the book.
I like that word a lot, of that definition and word.
There are tons of words that people use that aren't real words.
Oh yeah.
Even if that word isn't in the official dictionary, just the obscure sorrow one, I think that's what the podcast does, right? Like it makes us remember that there's other people out there whose lives are just as important as ours. And like just listening to someone's story.
I think we're all in some ways mini storytellers, as much as, you know, we can get a little bit lost. And I've tried to really change this with my own work, is not to get lost in the technique and get lost in the, you know, that stuff, which I think it's part of what we do. A lot of the art, you know, it's kind of based on a lot of things you figured out technically, whatever that is. But I think it's, yeah, like not getting so wrapped up in that, that you can kind of just let it come out and let it kind of flow without being so, you know, handcuffed by that.
I think different art has different trappings to it, like different disciplines. Do you think the people we generally talk to, artists, painters, sculptors, do you think, because they're so solitary, do you think they're sort of, they enforce a bit of a selfishness in you? Just like going by yourself, doing your thing all the time?
We're, I mean, what we do is by nature selfish in the sense that, you know, not in a bad way, but where it's about our, you know, our vision or our moment or our experience with this thing. So yeah, there is a bit of selfishness, especially time-wise, like that time suck that the life of an artist, like that you're just, it's just part of it. But I don't know if it, the question was, do you feel like it fosters selfishness by talking to other artists?
Yeah, I think so. No, not by talking to them, just the act of being the type of art we do, solitary work. Do you think that fosters a bit more selfishness in
yeah, people? For sure.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I don't know that it's self, like any fosters any more selfishness than like anything else that people do.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, when you start, it depends on how you look at it. If you break it down, it really is about like me, my studio, my time, my this, my vision, my painting, my hand, unless, you know, I don't know, you know, if there's other people who have a million assistants and everything, but it's still this one singular vision. I don't think
you're
a bad
painting
thing.
These things and like putting them out there. And yeah. I don't know. I mean, like doing the podcast for sure. Like selfish, it's like teaching is like incredibly selfish because the teacher always gets more than the student, but it's also, you know, it's kind of a, it's not quite parasitic. It's kind of mutually beneficial. Right.
I feel so. I definitely feel in a way that, like, with the podcast, like, at first it felt like it was something that we could be. I mean, so we restarted, like, or at least, I mean, I went off of it for a while and then we restarted recording kind of, you know, when things went on Zoom during COVID as, you know, possibly a way to stay sane. And at first it felt like it was something I could give people. And then I realized that what I'm getting from it is actually much more than, you know, like much more than what I'm giving, like the, just be like, I feel like some of the people we've interviewed have been so generous, both with like just time and the story of their life. And like in a way like now I feel like the podcast is something I do to like feed myself.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, you do, but like, you know, at the same time, it like, it's definitely, I mean, despite all the hate mail we get, we also get a lot of things that are like, I'm alone in my studio and you guys, you know, like I'm not near other artists, but I feel like I am. And, you know, this is, I mean, it feels like for those people, this is, you know, it's something that's really important and does really something as valuable to them as it is to us, you know, when we're enjoying getting to talk to artists. Mm.
Those are the emails that I think inspire me the most a lot of times outside of like, oh, you know, there's a great episode da-da, is the one that I'm not around other artists and I feel like I'm a part of something. Those are the ones that, you know, make me that I should keep doing, that we should keep doing this because it's important.
That's what makes us record once every 8 months.
That importance is top shelf. What about like, do you guys, so you could feed your like soul in many ways. And I think the four of us through conversations we've had are all extremely passionate about visual art. So this is particular for you, Tony and Ted. Who do you look at the most for those like to feed your soul? Artist.
Visual artists? Because actually lately, I have to say, and Dina and I talk about this a lot, like I've just reading, like I've been reading a lot. And I guess ever since COVID started, I just somehow have had more time to read. And I find books have been, like writers have been the artists that I've been most interested in.
Hmm. So who would a couple of those be?
I mean, right now I'm reading Demons. And I read, actually, there was a good book of lectures about Dostoevsky books by Joseph Frank, which if you love Dostoevsky, and he's kind of my guy, like that's my favorite. Although Dina and I are always talking about David Foster Wallace. Because we're the two people who made it through Infinite Jest and loved it.
Great.
You know, Marshall, Marshall is the third person. That's how me and Marshall became friends. We worked together and like we didn't, we never really talked, but once I figured out that Marshall was the one other person I could talk about Infinite Jest to, I'm rereading, or I'm actually like reading and listening to it in the car. Probably my favorite book of all time. Can I please, like, could someone please read it just so I can talk about it with them? It's Sometimes a Great Notion by Ken Kesey. Okay, same guy that wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right?
Oh, so okay.
He wrote four books. The last two, I think, are like after very heavy drug use and are like not particularly readable. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest might have been the first, and you know, it's pretty good. Like I don't know, there's a movie, it's good too. Sometimes a Great Notion is simultaneously the hardest sell on a book. Like if I try to describe it right now, you will actively try not to read it, right?
Can, like, you describe it?
Sounds like about the Pale King.
No, it's worse. It's about a logging op. It's about a union conflict at a logging operation in Oregon.
I'm out.
I think the 70s. Okay. Bear with me. It was
out the moment you said book, by the way.
Yeah.
Look, can I try to? I'm actually just maybe only going to pitch this to Ted because because he made it through Gravity's Rainbow, which I feel like makes him able to get through all sorts of long stuff. It is the most beautiful, heartbreaking, kind of like wildly individualistic book I've ever read. It is so good. It'll break your heart.
I will read it.
What happens at the end?
Our second annual reunion podcast. We'll discuss it.
We'll be a book.
Do we have homework? Yeah. Are you giving us homework, Dina?
Yeah, it's the book club. Suggested grind book club.
We could have a special episode that nobody's going to listen to, just to discuss Sometimes a Great Notion.
Art we were talking about.
Visual art.
Yeah, right. Tony, right. What about you? What visual artists?
I haven't been really looking at any visual art, you know, outside of like, oh, that's cool on something like Instagram or something, outside of, you know, the books that I have in my collection or something like that. So I haven't been looking at anything for inspirational purposes. I don't know why. I'd love to say because I don't want anything influencing my work because it's so singularly, like my vision is so singular. I don't know. I've just been kind of interested in looking or being surprised by inspiration in other places. And it's usually visual because I'd love to think that, that I'm spending so much time reading or listening to the latest amazing lecture from the smart people who are way smarter than me. But I don't know. I've just been trying to be open and aware of inspiration out there without searching. And I don't know if that's the smartest thing in the world, but outside of like the work that I just admire of the people we probably all admire, I haven't been really searching too much or really been moved by much work. And not because I don't like it or I feel like I'm better or anything, not at all. It's just because I've just been, I don't know, just a little bit more. I'm just kind of looking in other places right now just to see, because I'm curious if that might have some sort of influential change in something that I'm sort of weirdly looking for. It's almost that sometimes it's hard to describe. And it's funny because we're in the business sometimes of making things very visually sound, let's just say. Sometimes lately it's like I'm looking for something and I can't put my finger on it. I know what it is when I see it or feel it. It's hard to describe.
It's like what they say about pornography, right?
You know it when you see it. Yeah. Yes, porn. That's what I'm looking for. Porn. So I don't know.
I just saw a thing that Sharon Sprung just unveiled her portrait of Michelle Obama recently.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool.
I see that. Sharon Sprung's awesome.
She was one of my first art teachers, and she's amazing. Well, I guess not really one of my first, but one of my first at the Art Students League when I went there. So she's the best.
I have a question for you guys. I'm sorry, Dina, you were about to jump in.
Oh, you know, I actually wanted to ask, Marshall, what are you looking at? So you're the one that asked the question.
Well, I do look at a lot of paintings, like a ton. And I guess the two most recent that I've been like super into, Richard Dadd. Do you guys like him?
No.
He's so incredible. And like, so there are these really gorgeous paintings that were done in England in like the mid, like 1850s, I believe. And then he sort of went crazy, like had serious mental issues. And thought that Osiris was telling him to murder his father. So he does. He like cuts his father up into little like pieces with like razors and stuff. And no one knew who did it. And then they go, and then his brother is like, hey, you should check out Richard. He's been acting pretty strange, you know? And on his body, when they went in to question him, however that went in 1850, they found like he had written on his chest, like all the people who need to die that Osiris is telling him to die.
Whoa,
and his dad was like the top of the list. And so they're like, well, probably Richard probably did do this. And then they go through his sketchbooks and it's a bunch of decapitated people that he knew. And so he does not go to jail. Obviously he goes to a mental institution, which was what they would have called Bedlam back then. It was whatever, I forgot, it was like Beddingham or something that slang called it Bedlam. And in that mental asylum where he passed away, like he lived his whole life in institutions, did the most gorgeous, elaborate paintings I've really ever seen through 100% imagination because he had no reference. It's wild.
That's kind of crazy. Was he
killing people and then drawing their decapitated heads? Was that the decapitated heads?
These were alpha imagination too. So he would like sketch someone's portrait and then decapitate it in his sketchbook, you know,
decapitate.
Oh. He only killed his father. So.
Okay.
So it's like sketchbooks. It was like, wow, you know, Richard's pretty disturbed, but.
I mean, that was like. Middle school notebooks. Yeah, you know, exactly. Where you're just like, okay, dragons and decapitated heads.
Yeah.
But if you look at his like the paintings that he did in
what's his name? Richard's dad?
Richard Dadd.
D-A-D-D. Oh. I guess
it's ironic.
I was gonna say because you said Richard's dad, and I was like, wait.
Richard's dad's dad was killed by Richard Dadd.
It's Richard's, like Richard's dad is dead. Dad's yes. dead.
Yeah. Richard's dad's dad is dead because Richard Dadd killed his dad.
Yeah. Guys, this should all be edited out.
No.
like that was a terrible joke. Like,
it was
like
amazing.
The all of us just went in on.
It was amazing.
Man, look those
tour de force.
I'm going to be laughing about it tonight.
Remember that murderer guy?
I have a question sort of opposite of what you just asked.
Who are you not looking at?
Yes. And let me tell you, just let me start it off. And I want to get your opinion because it's interesting/not interesting to me. AI artwork. I see a lot of that coming up right now, and I don't, and I would look at it at first because there's something interesting about the randomness of it. And it just looks like so much crazy sci-fi stuff. It looks very science fiction, and I love science fiction stuff. But after I started seeing a lot of it, it became like,
it doesn't look sci-fi. It is sci-fi.
Yeah, I guess. Yes. Okay. What do you think of that? Are you looking at that, or are you just like not looking at that at all?
Ooh, I am so confused on that. Like there was recently a photograph that was in some show. It's just some small like show, I think in Colorado, but it won first prize for, and it was just a digitally created image. And there was scandal around it because I don't think it was disclosed that he had just basically spoken to that program Dolly or whatever, and it spit that out. But it was clearly better than what, you know, 99% of people come up with. So it was like, wow, that is crazy. And then on the heels of that, you know how when people do like,
I have a question really, because I don't know how it works all that much. I know it's a program. Is the description, the art, like, is somebody describing something going to make a better result than somebody who describes or asks for something not as thoughtfully? Like, does that matter in how it creates it, or it doesn't really matter? It just randomly creates whatever, regardless of how beautifully you ask for whatever you're asking for.
Well, there was this thing I saw that was kind of fascinating, that someone was speaking things into it backwards, like basically saying something, it comes out, and then sort of like using that as a prompt for the next image, but it was somehow backwards. And it reminded me of like old Satanic Panic stuff. And this crazy creature kept coming out of these images over and over again. And I saw a whole scroll through of these images with this same lady. And it was so creepy. And it's like, if we're doing like psychedelic explorations in our unconscious all the time, and you know how people on mushrooms always see like the purple lady and stuff.
Yeah. There's like a common thing that people are like, apparently there's a common thing that a lot of people who are tripping on ayahuasca or whatever, that there's like people, they're like, somebody would come up and be like, what are you doing here?
Yeah. Exactly.
And a lot of people are saying the same thing where they'll be like, there's a common thing where they're like, you made it. You like,
yeah,
exactly. Found it. Cool. How do you like it? Well, you know, okay, now, you know, we're good. Go back. That's crazy. But yeah, that
machines are getting sentient. They'll have the same collective, whatever that thing is, they'll tap in. And there will be these, I mean, not to get too trippy, but these same sort of spirits coming through those machines that we see. It's very bizarre.
You know, we're going to rip a hole in something.
I mean, like, we are trying to create the black hole of, you know, the podcast colliding. But, you know, Tony, to your question, I just as you were talking about it, I realized that so the AI art might actually be really interesting for itself. Like for, you know, like for exactly what it is, which might be a different thing from what we do. But what I realized that I'm not interested in is actually there's a huge potential for digital art. But whenever I see like, you know, just the only movies I watch really are with my kids. And when I like what it's not good for is actually humans, like it's human creativity and human.
You're talking about like computer graphics, like, I mean, CGI.
So CGI is, I mean, it's gorgeous and the potential is like, it's totally amazing, but it turns out that when most people use it to make a movie or make a cartoon, so when people had to draw every single frame by hand, they just had to, they spent so much time on this thing that they also spent a lot of time thinking about dialogue and thinking about these weird little like quirks that would make things, you know, funny or smart or like, you know, jokes that like went, you know, over the head of kids and into adults. And I feel like with CGI making everything so available, you don't have to do this frame by frame. And so everything just feels rushed for the most part, like with very few exceptions. So I started watching the new Game of of Thrones thing, and it's terrible. Or, in my opinion, it's terrible. But I was trying to figure out why it's so terrible. And I think part of it is because the budget for all of this beautiful CGI scenery is so huge, and they can do anything, and they're not spending any time actually concentrating on, like,
writing,
you know,
writing on things, like human, the dialogue or the script or something like that.
I'm not sure. It was that enough stuff that I, negative stuff that I'm just going to get canceled for, like,
no, being critical? Why would you? No, yeah. You're being, that's their thought, because I actually.
George R.R. Martin will cancel you.
But I agree with you with the CGI.
The money is the problem that they just have, and that becomes the focus, is just the. Like the expenditure of enormous sums of money. I mean, CGI is actually really hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, I who did do hand-drawn animation frame by frame. And I think it was actually a lot easier than, like, lighting and creating, you know, 3D characters that, like, Pixar is doing. I think that's actually harder.
That's something I've been playing around a lot with lately, is Blender and 3D art as making my own reference for work.
Yeah.
And that, Ted, you're absolutely right. That is harder than painting, getting these things just right. Yeah. But the joy of that is they're handmade. It's through a computer, but I'm making every move on these sculptures, you know, and lighting them. And that is so fun. It's been amazing. Like
I know for the iPad, like the iPad Pro or something, they have like Procreate, which is $10. If you have the iPad Pro and a iPad Pen, it's pretty amazing. Like, I go in there and I've messed around a little bit with it. I've done a few jobs, like designed a couple of things for Netflix and some movies coming up and everything. And I kind of forced myself to I took my daughter's iPad and just started playing with it. I was like, this is amazing. Hmm. You know? And then I looked, you go on YouTube, because you can find anything on YouTube, but like some tutorials and like to see what can be done. I was like, whoa, this is pretty amazing. So I'm not like poo-pooing that stuff at all. I think there's a lot of technology that I just think is amazing, and I'm kind of in awe of it. It just seems overwhelming because there's so much, and it goes so deep that I'm like, that's a whole language that I know myself, and I'll get obsessive compulsive, and all of a sudden I'll just be spending all my time trying to figure out, how to do this program or something.
I don't want to think too much about that stuff, because it makes like smudging pigment onto like a surface seem so humble and unimportant. I don't want to think too much about that.
But you know, I think I go down those routes too. But I think there is something, and this could be something we could talk about a little, like there does seem to be, just like maybe you could tell if an image was kind of photo collaged in Photoshop or something, they all have these sort of like artifacts that make you know how they were created. And I think painting has the same thing. I'm not just talking about like edges, but when something through like art history, all these people creating these images, there's always a technology that sort of like moves them to a different level, you know, like once they figured out mirror projections and stuff, you get like Vermeer and Caravaggio and things. And once like, so that's a level up. The Greeks figured out how to measure things, and that was a certain level. So it's always like, they always kind of work together in interesting ways. But I always feel like those handmade images always have something really, even with technology, something really beautiful about them that just can't get captured another way than someone making 10,000 decisions in front of a canvas, you know?
Right. And also the fact that they're happening like as a almost counterbalance to technology feels, and maybe to your point, Dina, like the things that all those people aren't thinking about, like maybe the sort of humble nature of just sitting alone in a studio and trying to make something that doesn't look horrible. Maybe that's like actually incredibly important.
I mean, I actually honestly, like, listening to you guys, I realize that maybe my gripe is with something I can't necessarily formulate. Like, it's, you know, like you guys are right. Like, the CGI stuff, it's not, you know, like, it's not easy and it's not thoughtless and it is incredible. And like, but the, like, and I see all the limitless possibilities of it. The stuff that sort of like gets me high art wise is still the handmade stuff.
So yeah. I don't think that stuff like, is like ever go out of fashion. This handmade stuff, I think, is always, there's going to be things that come and go and they'll stay because they will become part of our culture and important. But I think handmade anything is always going to be with us forever.
Do you guys think that, you know, Vermeer or Rembrandt or any of these people that we all, you know, like and respect, if they were living today, they'd be like, give me that Procreate, like give me that iPad. Yes. Like they'd romanticize
absolutely.
It.
But I think, yeah.
Yeah. I think Da Vinci would have been all over it. Like you know, a bit of modern technology.
Do you think Da Vinci would have just been like a businessman? Do you think he would have? He probably would have just been busy inventing stuff and he would never have bothered to paint.
He didn't even love painting in his own time. Did you ever read that treatise he wrote? He was looking for a job in like the court to design like war machines and stuff.
Oh, he loved theater design.
Theater design and like his trebuchets and stuff. And he was like, touting all of these things that he could do. And then at the bottom, the last sentence was, I can also paint. And he
also, if you need a portrait, come to Leonardo. Leonardo da Vinci.
Leonardo.
The portraits you love at the low, low prices.
Leonardo would probably have designed some insane program that would change everything, like a better tree bark
and grass.
Yeah. Or he would have been like, you know, the amazing filmmaker or something like that, you know, some genius filmmaker. Yeah. But most likely probably, you know, a better Google or like a better Apple or a better Amazon or something like that. That would be him.
You know, I think Michelangelo would have been the businessman, like, or like, I think he would have, like, I could totally see him being kind of a Jeff Koons type and just directing a lot of things. And like, do you guys know, so I only learned this pretty recently. Do you know that Michelangelo actually burnt like all of his drawings right before he died? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know why? Like, he said he didn't want people to see him struggle. He didn't want people to know that he struggled.
If the wine is sour, throw it out.
Throw it out.
on Leonardo, Michelangelo, do you guys, I don't know if this is my own just slant on art history, the things that I've picked up. I always see Leonardo as the coolest artist that ever lived, just top of the heap. Like if you want to be an artist, Leonardo is the model. And Michelangelo, just sort of a petty little sniveling villain.
I've never liked his whole attitude.
It's like, get out of here.
He definitely, I don't imagine that Michelangelo was like the coolest guy in the room for sure. I think he was probably a total spaz, but yeah, I never thought of him that way.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dina. I was going to say, it sounds like if you ever seen those little panels that says what my friends think I do, what the public thinks I do, what my parents think I do, what I really do. I feel like what I really do is, you know, what you would think like Michelangelo is like struggling and just being like, and surly. And what everybody thinks I do is like Leonardo, who is kind of fancy and, you know, really awesome, and everybody's like, ooh.
Did you ever have the thought though that Leonardo also like would have looked at Michelangelo and felt a little bit like a failure? Like he's off in Milan at this like suburb of Rome, like working for some duke, and Michelangelo is there in like the Vatican working for the Pope. He's got like all the big high profile gigs, and like Leonardo can never finish anything. He makes all these, he designs all these machines that never get built. Like it feels like there's like a crazy failure launch with him in a certain way, which is absurd, obviously. But like, I also always have that thought when I read about him.
I know what you're saying. I totally get what you're saying, but I've always felt like Leonardo knew it was more important to watch a swan fly and figure out flight than getting, you know, he had
be a beast with like a 18 foot piece of marble.
Well, yeah. I know I've said this on a podcast before, but the way that I don't think it really happened, but there's like this story that, and it kind of explains who they are. And I think it was because they lived in Florence at the same time. Leonardo was older, and I think Michelangelo, apparently the story is Michelangelo was trying to make a point. Michelangelo's trying to make a point to Leonardo, like they got into this argument. So he took like an iron bar and he bent it, also to show like how strong he was and everything. And Leonardo was apparently the kind of big dude too, and he took and he bent it back to like to sort of get the point. So I was just like, so that kind of describes a little bit of, you know, that's how I always saw them.
I've never heard that, but that's great. Did you see that in a cartoon?
Yes, it was in a CGI cartoon that I saw that was done by AI.
So, yeah. Dina created it.
Yes, Dina created.
I actually, when I was, I don't know, my like late teens, I read The Agony and the Ecstasy, the Irving Stone book about Michelangelo, and mm-hmm. I thought that being an artist was exactly like that.
it isn't?
And I kept it
for you.
you mean it isn't for you? So what I actually meant to ask you guys when I first asked you to do this like 6 months ago or maybe a year ago, I feel like the last 2 years have kind of put everyone through, like the world has been through a ringer of sorts, mm-hmm. where like COVID has just sort of like, you know, like taken all like the whole world like a towel and like wrung it out. And all of us are like, all of us are in a different place than we were 2 years ago, which might have been like, Tony, that might have been the last time I saw you in person. I wanted to know where all of you are just sort of like mentally after like after the ringing has been done.
Honestly, it's such a hard question to answer, because I think it's a universal thing, and there's a billion stories out there and it seems like everybody, at least for me, everybody I've talked to, every single person is like, yeah, everything is a little different, if not a lot different. So that feeling of what things were like before and after, it's weird now, because it's just like everything just seems, I don't know, how do you describe this? Everything in the prior just doesn't seem real anymore. Like, where we are now is like, it almost seems like that's all we know. All I know, because like the last, whatever, 3 or 4 years have been so kind of traumatic and weird and just strange in general, that's all I feel like I know now. So it's a hard one. I would say, I don't know. It's a hard one to, without it being this like really long answer that probably is going to meander and not answer it and not say anything. It's just, it's different.
I feel like in a way, this will sound wrong, but maybe like less ambitious, like almost like I want to focus on smaller things, just focus my attention on things that aren't grand, just like are simple in a way. I also definitely feel like the whole experience of the last whatever 2 or 3 years, or however long it's been, has like, I've leaned into being a parent a lot more than, you know, I don't fight it quite as much as I used to.
But Ted, you know what? One thing I actually did hear this recently, and I didn't even realize this, but when I heard it on like a podcast or something, I was like, oh my God, I think this person might have a point. Do you know kind of the 90s and the 2000s? There was always
never heard of them.
There was that like uptick of like, go out there and like get it. go out and not like an 80s like greed thing, more like better yourself, work harder, grind harder, be a little bit better than the next person, wake up a tiny bit earlier to like get an advantage of just like on you, and also be like, go out and work out and like do all that time in the studio or wherever.
There was a suggested grind in the 90s for sure.
Yes. And that was like a thing, whether it's like a self-help book type of thing or just that go out there and be your best person and get it, go get it. I feel like that's a very 2000 thing, like mid 2000s, that I think there's this kind of, and I don't think it's, I don't know if it's the pandemic, but a reversal of like, you know what, maybe I just want to work a little bit less and enjoy the simple things a little bit more.
Well, also, because where it does that like go? You can't like, do that. What's that about? Know. What is it?
But what does the other thing go? Just, we're going to just work harder and be better and better and better and better. Like,
no, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's,
oh, I'm sorry.
Where does that go? Like where, like know. Eventually, like, I don't
know. Success, whatever that means. Success, what, you're going to be better, bigger, stronger, you know?
Ted, how has it felt focusing on smaller things? Like what does that feel like to you?
I think that's my natural tendency anyway. Like I have like big paintings overwhelm me. And I say that I'm working on two big paintings now, but there's something about just taking the time to do kind of something. It's almost, maybe it's like a different, you were talking before about like every painting being something new. And, you know, I guess one thing I've tried recently, and it's made me sort of very happy, the process of doing it, is trying to do the thing that I know how to do and just try and do it like a little bit better, like make it just a little bit more perfect than anyone that I've ever done before. And I mean, I paint waves endlessly, but like, and you know, different kinds of conditions and scales and material, whatever, but just trying to do it like something that's very simple and very calm, and just trying to do it like, you know, reaching towards that like impossible perfection that you're always after, like just settling into that. And, you know, big paintings are important because you can sell them for enough money that you can actually pay bills, and small paintings you can't. And so it's sort of hard. And I think during the pandemic, I feel like I've been able to kind of scale back and just take the time to do that and to just like, you know, fall in love with that process again.
So you feel like maybe it's helped you get closer to your true priorities or true self in that way, maybe.
I don't know if it's a true self, but it feels fulfilling in a certain way now. You know, and I think maybe before I don't know, I wouldn't have taken the time to do something that I feel like I've done before, but just try and do it better.
I feel like we've been through like, to Dina's question, I feel like maybe this is like year three of this thing, right? Aren't we in like year three? And it's like, there's been three waves. Like there was that initial scramble to figure out, oh, we got to figure out what Zoom is. We got to do classes online. How long are we locked down? What is this? What are, you know, just figuring out the borders of what's going on. And then it feels like in the middle there was enough momentum from the beginning to just keep you going through it. And that like year two in those teachings was weird too, just sort of the city and all that. It was like, all in some ways, like the trains were less packed, so that was nice. And like all that just moving around had a real novelty to it. And now I feel like we've hit everyone I'm talking to. It's just like that energy is gone, and it's just we've settled into the PTSD of this whole thing.
It's like a different thing. You know what's interesting about what you just said that just reminded me of something is as artists in the arts, whether it's movie, literature, paintings, even like stand-up comedy, I thought there would be a lot more like art about the pandemic, whether there's movies about the pandemic, whether it's like stand-up comedians talking about, like, you know, all the jokes they made up about the pandemic, and or paintings. I haven't, outside of like that first year doing the little COVID like symbol, I haven't seen anybody, like, the art that I've seen isn't like, oh, this is like art about the pandemic, outside of like putting a mask on somebody. No, I haven't seen anything that sort of
toilet paper early on.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Something that. Like that. You know, I haven't seen any of that. And to be honest, like, I'm fine with it. Like, if somebody figured out a clever way to represent what it was like in the pandemic via painting or drawing, I don't know.
If somebody made a movie about the pandemic right now, I would definitely not watch it. I would have
zero
interest.
Not only that, I also think it's in the past that it would almost be like, oh, that was like yesterday's news, even though it's still happening. I feel like it's almost like played out.
I couldn't even watch Station 11, which was based on a book I really liked about an imaginary pandemic. But you know, I think we're in for a whole slew of terrible pandemic books. Like, I think everything.
You think they're coming?
Yeah.
You think that's coming?
Do you remember how after September 11th, like 2 years went by and every single artist and writer decided that it is their duty as an artist and writer to respond emotionally to September 11th. And some of those things were very good, but a lot were awful. I think we're in for, actually,
I'll be reading Ken Kesey.
You'll be reading Ken Kesey because it's very long. I just read a bad pandemic novel. Gary Steingart, who can sometimes be very, very good, just wrote a very, very bad novel about, you know, like pandemic lockdown. Guys are interested.
No.
I do think we went through something very, I think, culturally extremely traumatic, you know.
Of course. I would read something if there was a writer who like had an interesting sort of thought about it. I would be very interested in reading something, but I don't want to read like the history of it. I don't want to read like individual stories about what people, you know.
I think it would have come out. I mean, me personally, I think if it was going to come out, it would come out already. Is there going to be trickles of it? Yes. But I think if it something that was like, oh, pandemic-y art, I think about the pandemic, I think it would have come out already. So I don't know. I think
we all got a little more time in the studio. We all, which,
speak for yourself. They don't go anywhere for like during the pandemic.
I'm talking to parents, I guess. So I got a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Marshall got a little more time in the studio.
Congratulations, Marshall. Yeah.
Hey guys, it was great.
Marshall. Me. Remember that selfish.
Back to the selfish question.
Yeah. I had a.
Has it improved? I don't feel like any of us are making pandemic work, but has it improved your practice at all?
No, I don't think so.
No.
It didn't. It maybe made like so sort of that initial lockdown of just sort of like single parenting two small needy kids while working eight different freelance jobs and trying to make art was so intense for a while that I think it kind of like it made me into a different person, but not a better one. And I don't think my art got better and I didn't become better. I just became different.
Yeah.
There was a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
You had time to, Ted, when did you have time to think?
Pretty much that point from like going to the, you know, going in the bathroom and just being like, I'm by myself for like a second. That's my time to think.
How about like making, when I'm like making breakfast, lunch and dinner for my kids, you know?
Pretty much.
Man, wow. We had such different experiences.
Oh yeah. Marsha's like, this is awesome.
No, but you know, it wasn't like that. Like, so Marshall, by the way, so Ted, I saw you probably about six, I don't know, the next time I went back to New York when things started reopening a little bit, and I saw Marshall at about the same time. Marshall was in much worse shape. Like, Marshall was wearing a mask inside the house. Like, remember that time you and Ton came to stay with me and you just wouldn't take the mask off? And I was like, how are you planning to, or drink? Or I think like emotionally in a way it hit you harder because you didn't have to like cater to the demands of like yelling little people.
Well, and I mean, I had, you guys had huge responsibilities with your kids, but like I was still through the pandemic, some schools teaching in person, and it was like that you had to be super responsible, you know? So it was, and it was tough, you know, like to think about every aspect of how could my actions affect anyone else, you know, was pretty, it was emotionally draining for sure.
Oh yeah.
Everything was considered.
It hasn't totally left me. I'm sorry, Dina.
Oh no, you did, Tony, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I got COVID for the first time just like a month ago. Yeah. And you know, it's before that. And even after, I'm still like, you know, I want to make sure that if it happens again, I want to make sure that everybody around me, like I'm trying to be really responsible as like a, you know, good citizen to be like, oh, I got to do my part.
Make I am sure never, that, like, ever going back to not wearing a mask on the subway or in public restrooms.
I'm actually sort of with you on that.
Planes. Like
this is just a good idea regardless.
Yeah. Yes. It improves the experience exponentially. Like,
yeah, I agree.
I remember one day everybody was on the subway wearing masks. There was one guy who had a balled up paper towel over his face. And he, at one point, he pulled the paper towel away from his face and he made this noise. It was it was like, ah! And then he put it back on. There was just some horrible smell in the subway. Nobody really knew what it was, but like everybody with masks on was pretty happy. And this one
guy, you didn't realize that there was a horrible smell.
He knew it. He was just, he but was trying to keep this thing.
Oh, I didn't when he took it oblivious. Off, he realized the smell. Oh, wow.
Like this is what it smells like in the subway. Oh my God. We're just all like, we were used to it. We didn't realize it. Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Whatever. I miss, like, you know, like I miss it when you didn't have to think about the stuff and like when you could just go into the subway and not, you know, the
I mean, nobody's wearing them on the subways except for me.
Actually, the last time I was in New York, it was basically exactly like it used to be, except with a few masked people like Ted looking, you know, a little bit judgy, you know, a little.
Just I'm not looking judgy. I'm just enjoying it. I'm enjoying a much better experience than the rest of the people.
I'm with you. And like, you know, my dad, I remember him as a kid being so into like changing the air filter and stuff on your car. Like that was super important for him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he's like an anti-masker. And it's like, you put your air filter on your car all the time.
You'll get better air to your car than to your,
in your body. It's so weird.
I think there's a lot of, in all of us, there's a lot of hypocritical stuff that sort of reared its ugly head during the pandemic that I was like, this doesn't make total sense. I'm one way, but another way. Two fighting forces within me. I don't know about this.
It did seem to have like what it did is I think it brought out a lot. So it brought out a lot of people's like really sort of, you know, like better impulses. Like especially in the beginning where people would get, you know, like donate money for PPE supplies for doctors when it was a thing. And like, there's an amazing amount of people that like kind of came together for this, but then it also maybe because people had more time to just be themselves, it brought out all the bad qualities of maybe all of us.
I don't know if it's them being themselves or maybe just spending too much time on the internet at the time, fosters that.
Yeah, Zoom is a horrible thing. I mean, we're all here because of it. And thank you, Zoom. Yeah. This podcast brought to you by Zoom. The truth is like, it's so much, if we were all in a room together, we'd be having, we're having a great time, all of us, but we would be having a better time.
Oh, and social media has hyperactivated everyone's worst impulse.
That's right.
Pushed on them to where now people don't even believe half the stuff they're saying.
You can't blame that stuff on COVID. That was happening before COVID.
That's true. That's very true. But yeah. I feel like it hypercharged everything.
I think it just made it worse. And it was like Mike Tyson, you know, I think he was one, like the keyboard warrior type of people. He's like, these people have never been punched in the face before. Like you wouldn't do that in front of like somebody. And like, there's a certain amount of the way we conduct ourselves in front of people that just wouldn't happen. I mean, the way they conduct ourselves on behind the screen, that wouldn't happen in person until now. It almost seems like they're taking that same attitude of being a shithead and going out in the real world and doing that. And it's like, dude, that's like, no, that's bad.
And onto a very important platform. Like we're all on these things and they prioritize bad behavior. Like they reward it. So it's like, you got to wonder how that's shaping people's brains and priorities and all kinds.
But that's also been happening long before social media. I mean, that's, you ever watch Jerry Springer?
Yeah, that's so true.
But I think Tony and me, Marshall, actually, I feel like me, you, from this conversation ages ago, is that like there's certain things that you wouldn't say to a person in a bar because there's always, you know, at some point there's a risk of getting punched in the face. Yeah. And I feel like people behave online in a way that they do without the repercussion of being punched in the face.
And a bartender doling out free drinks for bad behavior is how it is. Here's more likes. Like, we're upvoting this tweet because you said something that.
Yeah, it's like getting the drunk people more belligerent and more drunk. Exactly. That's a great point. That's a great point, Marshall. I like that.
That's actually a good analogy. Getting them more drunk so that they can keep, so they can stay at the bar for longer.
For longer money, drinks, like,
and yeah. The money they're spending is. Yes, as a currency, is their attention span, like our attention span. Like this is what the stuff is taking from us, right?
I have a question then.
Yes.
I thought this and you know, is there a question that you
this one wish, comes from the listeners?
Yes. Is there a question that you wish you ask a guest that you did it? Or there's something you're like, and you know, it's like you thought of it afterwards. You're like, I wish I asked that.
Actually, that conversation with Israel Hirschberg, I feel like I played in my head over and over again, being like, I wish I said this. And I wish I like stood up to him. I disagreed with him so strongly. And at the moment, because I think I want to please people, it was just really hard to come up with like anything to say that like
it's hard in a debate or an argument to think of the perfect like one-liner or something like that, or just like the perfect point.
I felt like I needed to, you know, I needed to be respectful to him, but it was in the boundaries of that. There's a whole bunch of things that came to my mind, like 2 weeks later, where I was like, that would have been so clever and witty and yet respectful. And like, but it was like way too late.
I feel like my brain moves way too slowly to come up with anything clever to say quickly, but also, I do find that like when I listen to the podcast, like when Jay sends the edit and I'm listening, I'm always like, I should have asked this question. And like 1 minute later, I'll ask that question. I just will have totally forgot that I asked it.
I've noticed that too. Yeah, the few, I notoriously never listen to ours, but I've had to for editing purposes a couple of times. And it is weird to hear your own thought process through it because you're like, your mind goes to that place.
Same place,
And then you say it, it's like, whoa, that is weird.
it's like
I know that person.
The same person. That almost makes me feel bad for two reasons. One, because my memory is not good enough to remember exactly what I said. And then two, that I'm like, just stuck in the same loop that I can't like Dina come up with something new to say that I wish I said.
Well, man, it makes you think
Groundhog's Day.
You know,
I guess everything makes me feel bad, but
ponder aspects of free will and stuff. And boy, when you hear that, you will think there really is not much choice.
The algorithm that controls my brain.
Yeah.
I remember once when James Gurney was on and with Dinotopia books, which I love, and everything about the humans and dinosaurs living side by side. And I always wanted to know, I was like, did you ever get emails from people being like, you're telling the truth, from those like creationists? Oh, I want to know if he's like had like fan mail of people being like, you're the only one who's really telling the way it really happened. And see if he was like, I don't know if he ever got those, but I would be dying to know if people are like, 6,000 years ago, that's the way it was.
Okay, well, here, okay,
even the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are way off, even like 20 years from now. Like, they would know more about the Velociraptor, that they were actually quite tiny and would have feathers and stuff like that.
Yeah. And is that confirmed, like, the whole feather thing? I thought that's just a theory.
I think it's confirmed. I mean, from, you know, from my extensive dinosaur study.
You heard it here first.
But I do know, Velociraptor's like the size of a turkey. And they didn't even think, when Jurassic Park was made, that they were more akin to like a chicken than they are. You know, they're thought of as a little more like big lizards.
Well, the movie's not very scary if it's like six chickens attacking.
I know, right?
Dude, I beat the shit.
You're
out
being
of a
hunted by six chickens.
Look, I think I can
clever girl.
Yeah. This chicken doesn't want to be fed. She wants to hunt.
Okay. You know what my regrets. You know what my regret is? I regret what? Not writing James Gurney a more enticing email to be an Art Grind guest, like that he would actually agree to, because I love those Dinotopia books as a kid.
No, James Gurney is like, awesome. Yeah.
Well, James Gurney, both me and Marshall failed to talk him. Like, we offered to drive up there, we offered to do it on Zoom, and apparently both of us were just off-putting enough to him.
he's very discerning. I mean, I don't want to insult you guys, but he's very discerning. He doesn't choose just any podcast to go.
Apparently not.
Yes. Impeccable taste.
Yes,
James.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't think of anyone with better taste.
He only goes to the finest podcasts.
Oh my God.
So
I haven't, I'm sorry.
You know, I mostly, there's some things that I wish I had asked, but I feel like there's also a lot of the time, a lot, like, mostly when I think about the podcast, I think of times when I ran my mouth off and wish that I hadn't said something, and then it didn't get edited out. That happens all the time.
And even with all the cutting out of like 90% of what we said, we still say way too much, and also say the same, like, ask the same question six times, interrupting the guest when they're trying to answer it to ask it a seventh time before we let them answer it and then interrupt them again.
It's hard. It's hard because there's a nervous energy around doing these things. You know, you want it to be good. You're usually meeting someone for the first time, and it's like, oh God, I hope like I give them a chance to say what they want to say. I hope I get some nice, like, get a chance to ask some good questions and stuff. And especially when we first started, there was just a nervous energy around it. That's a learning curve that I don't think served those early episodes well, you know?
Yeah. Also, I think it's when we take really long breaks like this, like we did for, you know, for a while. We haven't recorded in a while, but we're going to restart recording. I actually think it's like there's a acclimation back to doing it that is going to take
you
a
guys.
Couple of podcasts, you know? Yeah.
Nina and I experienced that too. Like, it feels like we're not terribly consistent. We've been doing it better lately, but boy, you can really feel it when you're a month off, because it's like you're kind of re-meeting Dina, and then a new guest pops on, and it's like it all happens within like 30 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
No, Marshall, me and you have a lot of in-between conversations about why we're not recording this week and who failed to arrange what, and, you know, the logistics aren't working out. So it never feels like I'm re-meeting you, because I just had this conversation with you about like our logistical failures. So.
hey, what do you think about repeat guests? I know there's so many people out there I want to talk to, but every once in a while I'm like, I wouldn't mind getting somebody back in.
Pete Van Dyke, maybe.
Well, we did that, but
he's our only repeat guest, right?
Exploring deeper into something that isn't like, you know, how did you start and what did you do and where did you study, to sort of see where they're at and maybe tap into something that we didn't get to the first time. What do you think of that?
I would actually love getting like a few of the people we interviewed in person before COVID, is I feel like when something really like, I don't know, extreme happens to person or the world, like we don't exactly survive it, right? Like we turn, or we turn into a different thing, and everyone's turned into a different thing. And I want to know who those people are now. Like I want to know, like partially, I feel like we met a lot of people that we really liked. I'd like to have those people back and just to see who they are right now.
Yeah. Also, there are those artists. I mean, both of us have had on that. You just like, you could listen to forever. And those people, like, I'd always want to hear more from them, but also particularly to hear their perspective on whatever just happened or is still happening. Like, I would love that.
Yeah,
I agree. And I think one aspect sort of to your early question, Tony, like, is there a question you didn't think to ask? So many people, you sort of, well, it's part of the benefit of doing the podcast and what's good for the listener, you figure them out in real time. You know, when it's over, it's like, now I understand where that person's coming from. And it does feel like circling back around with a better understanding.
Because you have a whole new slew of questions now that I understand this person a little bit better. All of a sudden, a bunch of new questions come up.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So I'd be, we haven't done it yet, Dina, have we? I don't think we've had a repeat yet.
We just talk about doing it, but we don't actually do it.
Who would be your guy's first repeat guest? If you could, right today, like somebody who, you know, you could invite somebody back, who would it be?
Israel Hirschberg.
Round two. Let's get ready to rumble.
So this is like sort of like an easy one, but I'd listen to Vincent Desiderio talk about anything, awesome. any time of day. Like he's so almost magnetic when he talks that I don't know, in a way I feel like he could be reading the telephone directory out loud and I'd be like, really? Tell me more. But yeah, I feel like he has so much more to say beyond that like hour and a half that we talked to him.
Yeah, he was really fun to talk to when we talked to him. He was intense, super thoughtful. It's been a while, but yeah, I remember, I think Ted and I both left that conversation. We were like, that was awesome. You know?
Yeah, that was definitely one where I walked away feeling like I learned something. And like, that was one also where I wanted to like go back and listen to it again, because I felt like he said a lot, like he speaks very densely, I think. And there's a lot there to unpack.
Miriam Escafette, that would probably be my first choice, just because like, I think I fell in love with her a little bit during the pod. Like she seemed so cool that like, by the end of it, like I liked her paintings, but by the end I was like, I just want you to be my friend.
Yeah, that was I think for me, it's probably Justin Mortimer. Like I like that conversation a lot. I found him very inspiring and really like authentic. And I'd definitely love to talk to him again.
Oh, you know who I loved, who you guys talked to, who was supposed to be here with us doing this, Justin Hopkins.
Oh,
he's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's great. Like, I hung out, you know, with him once, and you know, he made an impression, and then I listened to him when you guys interviewed him, and I loved that podcast.
Yeah, he was great.
So when I first wanted to do this thing, I wanted to do it with him and the guy he recorded. Like, yeah, I wanted to be like a great gathering of podcasting, you know. Podcasting wizards, and it felt like it was just so hard to coordinate even the four of us that like that but yeah, he was so smart and like quirky and a great storyteller.
Is
there anybody you haven't gotten, here's a two-part question: is there anybody you haven't gotten that you really, really want to get not saying that you reached out, just like, man, I'd love to talk to that person. And is there somebody, if you had a person that you can talk to, let's just say in the 20th century, dead or alive, like who would that person be? So is there somebody that you like, I'd love to talk to this person. I'm really curious to talk to this person. And if I could have this person on who might not be with us, or, you know, I would love to talk to that person. Like a dream guest that might not be, you know, dead or alive.
My dream guest was not an artist, and I wrote her and she didn't respond, but Emily St. John Mandel, the woman who wrote Station 11, and she's a writer. She lives in Brooklyn. She wrote this book that I felt like it's not the best book written in the last 100 years, but it's probably one of my favorites. It does happen to be about a post-pandemic world, but you know, she wrote it way before all of this happened. So I wrote her, I told her I considered a quote from her book, getting it tattooed, which I did.
You did? Look at you.
Maybe I came off too strong.
What's the quote that you got tattooed?
I didn't get it tattooed.
What's the quote that you wanted to get tattooed?
It's a quote that the main character of her book has tattooed. It's actually a Star Trek quote. It's "Survival is insufficient." Just because that's I feel good. Like it more or less sums up why we do anything, right? Including this and including art, right? Because there's survival.
Can I get that tattooed?
And then there's everything. Yeah. Yes. Apparently, my parents really don't want me getting a tattoo, and that's enough to prevent me from. So in any case, maybe I shouldn't have written that to her though, maybe that creeped her out rather than.
Maybe had you actually gotten a tattoo, she would have done the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Send her
she was offended that you were like, what? It wasn't good enough to disappoint your grandmother.
You should get the tattoo, cut it off your skin, send it to her, and then say, can you be on my podcast?
You won't even tattoo it on your arm?
That's definitely the way to ingratiate yourself to someone, just getting weird things about them tattooed on yourself. I've done that with a lot of people during my dating life.
Oh no.
Have you guys read that book, by the way?
No.
Station 11?
No.
So don't watch the HBO show.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
No. The show sucks. But the book is about, it's about this traveling symphony / Shakespeare company. And they're wandering through what used to be the Midwest, before a pandemic wiped out like 99% of the population. And they're performing for like the 20 people that are, like squatting in an old gas station or like a little village. Is now like where a Walmart used to be, and they're perform. But what they're performing is like Hamlet and classical music and all the stuff that they're trying to keep alive. And so a lot of the point of it, like, is there what the book is trying to say is like, is there a point to art if nobody's really looking and nobody knows all these references anymore? And like the kids being born into that world, like they've never, a lot of this stuff is just completely anathema to them. Like, is there still a point?
That doesn't
to
sound
art?
Like science fiction.
It's a good book. It's an easy read. It's a good book. I don't know. It's got that great Star Trek quote.
I like that.
Answer the question, Forestina. Is there a point to making art? Is it sort of like if a tree falls in the wood and no one's there to hear it? Does it fall? Is there a point to making art without people seeing it?
Or why do we do this? Like, why do we keep doing this? Even if sometimes it feels like there's no audience for it, or like a lot of the audience for this is, maybe has been dead for 400 years. Like, why do we, and especially for all of us, like we keep some of these traditional painting techniques alive at a time when like a lot of people don't really care that much, but we're doing it for a reason, right?
And like, we could survive without it. Survival is insufficient. Is that the reason?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously not doing this for survival because there's better ways to survive. But then, like, if survival is insufficient, then all of it kind of makes sense.
First name that popped into my mind was Francis Bacon. I think
he would be great,
fun to talk to, and the interviews I've seen with him and some of the, he was whip smart and hilarious. And I love his paintings too. And he would definitely be that dream guest to talk.
I didn't see Francis Bacon as being hilarious. I could see him as being super smart, but intense. I could say, I would think he would be like this intense person. You're like, whoa, this guy comes hard.
He's very playful. Like he knows he's kind of funny and he'll just laugh. And he would like, there's some interviews with like David Sylvester and even some of them are filmed. And he is just teasing and drunk and they're great. And it was like, that's who I'd want to.
That sounds kind of awesome. Ted, do you have a person that you'd be like, man, that'd be pretty cool. Whether it's, I don't know. You can always say the obvious ones, like the big ones, but you know what? I'll answer really quick. I think just because it's recent, but he's no longer with us. Andrew Wyeth, I thought would be a pretty interesting person.
Great guest.
And just because of like his history, his father's history, all that stuff. He seems super intense. I remember reading his biography and just being like, wow, this guy was like pretty intense, dude. I thought he would be kind of interesting guy. As far as like art podcasts and getting an artist in here would be like, Andrew Wyeth would be pretty cool to get.
Yeah.
That's a great.
If we manage to bring Andrew Wyeth back from the dead and you guys get him on suggested donation, can we do another joint episode?
Oh, hell yeah, that'd be super sick.
Hey, but you know, Jamie's an incredible painter and he's still around.
He's awesome. Yeah
he's awesome.
Could we maybe ask Jamie Wyeth and then he would talk about his family and we could get some of the information that way.
I don't know. I think the whole totality of the why is, I think Jamie has my favorite painting of all three of them, which is that creepy dog in the bassinet. You guys know that?
That's one. I remember his pumpkin head painting.
Oh, love them. Those are so good.
Those are really awesome. He's a really very cool artist. Ted, do you have somebody you would think of like in the arts?
That's a pretty great one, Andrew Wyeth. I definitely, that's, he would definitely be, it would also be fun to talk to David Foster Wallace going back to. I feel like talking to him about art, particularly like painting, would be really interesting. Cause I do actually think I've read stuff that, I mean, I think he has opinions on it and I think they would probably be opinions like more or less that would be of interest.
That's a great pick.
Well, honestly, I think if I had David Foster Wallace in front of him, I'd probably just want to talk about Infinite Jest and try to like figure out what really happened to Hal and, you know, like did he take that drug or not, etc. But he had one of my favorite quotes about kind of contemporary art, or like the kind of conceptual contemporary art that, you know, like he didn't understand, but he said that it was, I'm gonna butcher this. He said that it was kind of like, it was kind of like a party where, you know, the parents were gone and, you know, and everyone just sort of trashed the house entirely. Right. Like all, you know, and at this point, like the, you know, like it's like we killed our parents, but we didn't necessarily, you know, like we killed the art history behind us, but didn't necessarily create anything new. And right now it's the point of the party where someone's thrown up in the rug, their cigarette burns like all over the couch. And you kind of just wish that the parents would come home and like, you know, make some sense of it all. And then you realize that right now, like you are the parents. It's our job to, like it's our job to, you know, clean it all up, or like, you know, or to come up with something new
or just abandon the house
or abandon the house, because I think for a while so like it was all about breaking rules. So like what happens after we, you know, after all the rules are broken,
right, what's, you know, left.
I always wanted to get like you know, somebody who would be a scientist, or somebody who would, you know, who's figuring out black holes or something, like a Michio Kaku or any of these like super smart, I mean, they're alive, but even like a Stephen Hawking or something like that, and be like, let's talk about art and see what their take, somebody who's so one way, super smart, but like they think about space or something like that, or a physicist, some sort of physicist, and see what their opinion would be as an artist to talk to somebody like that about what their ideas of art is. I always
maybe we could get Neil deGrasse Tyson on.
I'd love to talk. I mean, he's so entertaining and he's such like a showman too. And he's super smart. He would be great. Cause I've listened to his podcast. And when he would every once in a while break off into something that would be maybe in more of an art thing, it's super interesting. It's really like a really smart take on
something. He'll do it. He'll do it in a second. We just have to march over to the natural history, to the planetarium, and
get a tattoo of his quote on our bodies and go there and be like, get to be on our podcast.
I have to go, guys.
He popularized that idea of Manhattan Hinge, where it's like the light going through the building. You could get that tattooed on yourself.
Wait. So before we all have to go, do we have any, like, you know, it's like the new year's beginning. It's September. I feel like the whole year, you know, everything is like bright and shiny. Do we have any resolutions for, you know, like the
exercise,
podcast eat less donuts. Exercise, less donuts. Record podcasts.
Yeah,
record more than once a month.
I got two things, and I'll just. It's like. You're right. I want to record a lot more podcasts like now. I'm finishing off a couple of commissions, a few commissions that have been sort of on me for the last few years. And once I finish those off, I made a pact with myself to do paintings and really push the envelope on something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. So I think that's something that I'm really looking forward to, is to do the paintings I've been wanting to do for like 6 years and I haven't, or even more, and not be afraid and be uncomfortable, like be willing to be uncomfortable and move forward. So that's something I'm really looking forward to, but I just got to get through a few more commissions and I'm good to go, hopefully. How about you guys?
I made one in real time on this conversation. I'm definitely going to take my phone out of the studio for a few hours.
That's a good idea, man.
It's Dina, like something that's been in the back of my mind, and it gets worse and worse. And it's like, I'm just going to treat it like a New Year's resolution. Just like, all right, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So guys, that was so much fun. Thanks for all, well, we joined you and you joined us.
It was mutual.
Tony, Ted, Dina, thanks. This was a great time. I had a blast with you guys. Thanks so much for coming on.
This will be one of many. I think we should do this every so often.
Yeah, let's do humble. A catch up periodically.
I agree. Yeah, this is a ton of fun.
But a lot of people might stop listening because we, you know, lose focus.
We need to check in to see how our resolutions went.
Oh, that's true. Maybe by New Year's, when we're making new resolutions, we can see our September resolutions.
Yeah.
So we just had a joint episode of Suggested Donation and Art Grind. We're going to call it the Suggested Grind. But guys, thank you so much for doing this with us. We finally all showed up.
Thank you for doing the heavy lift of the organizing, Dina.
You mean badgering everyone because I knew it would be fun and I knew that we'd all be happy once we actually did it. One more thing to anyone who's listening. So one of our past guests, April Coppini, is having kind of a health crisis with one of her kids who like urgently needs neurosurgery. And April is currently alone, trying to, you know, being a full-time caretaker for her child and trying to raise what seems like an insane amount of money for the surgery, just so her child can, you know, walk and have a reasonably normal life again. So she's got, she's an amazing artist. We had her on a few months ago before all of this started happening, but if anyone has any money to spare, please send it her way. She has a GoFundMe and you could just check out her Instagram page at April Coppini and kind of read about it. And it's really, really heartbreaking. And if there's anything that any of us can do to help, just, please do it.
Dina, can you spell her last name so people can find her on Instagram or something to get to that that page?
It's April Coppini, Coppini, And yeah, she's like the GoFundMe thing is just a link in her bio.
If you can help, please help, dude.
Yeah, please help, because she's an amazing artist. One of my favorite episodes that we talked to, like, it was so touching. We've gotten so much email feedback about people really enjoying her, and her story is motivating and inspiring and intense all at the same time. So, you know, she's got another hurdle to go through. So you guys, we don't really do sponsorships. We don't ask for much. So if you could put whatever money you would send to those things, just send it to her. So
awesome. Well, hey guys, this was awesome. And I really mean it. We should do this again, because you know, sitting around talking with friends and talking about art and having fun and joking is a great time. So thank you so much, Art Grind.
This was a blast.
Yeah, super fun.
And thank you to everybody listening. Support the podcast, support, you know, independent creators like we are, to do, you know, to do things like this by whatever, liking and leaving some messages, but
buy art
by living artists if you can, because it means, like they said, the dead ones don't need it anymore. So the living do. Thank you, everybody. You're all right. Awesome. We'll see you all and talk to you all soon. Thanks.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertain you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us, whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG @artgrindpodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.